I am very proud to announce today that we have reached a deal to end the shutdown and reopen the federal government. As everyone knows, I have a very powerful alternative, but I didn't want to use it at this time. Hopefully it will be unnecessary.
Fuck that guy.
Starting off on a professional note here. And with that announcement, obviously the 35-day partial federal government shutdown gave way on Friday to a new three-week continuing resolution and negotiating window, which will doubtlessly end in the legislative and executive branches, the Democratic and Republican parties, coming together to hash out a sound bipartisan policy that fixes not just immigration policy, but all of our long-term budgetary and fiscal issues forever. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason Podcast. My name is Screenslaver, and I just read out that hostage note without laughing, for which I deserve a Screen Actors Guild award, or at least nomination. I'm actually Matt Welch, joined by my snorting colleagues, Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Good Monday, my colleagues.
What are we snorting?
I have not snorted anything yet this week, and I'm holding you personally responsible.
Literally, just Monday.
I was just going to say, I just wanted to say it's a pleasure to be here.
That was told with conviction. So we've been talking about shutdowns and immigration the past God knows how many Mondays. So I would like to take a step back here now that this has come to a glorious close. And have you all share with the class, South Park style, what did we learn during the government shutdown? Catherine, you are the boss of me. You go first.
I think I learned that Nick Gillespie is right about some things, which let's all take a deep breath before we continue on that. This was a great example in a microcosm of this hobby horse that Nick has been riding for a long time and which will soon appear as a essay in Reason Magazine about how there is this paradoxical thing where when government is really, really bad and everyone agrees that government is really, really bad at doing the things government is supposed to do, people want more government. Obviously, I, like Peter Suderman, live in D.C., so I have, a very, very weird sample on this. But the notion that this partially shut down government was both a moral abomination and also a sign of how we need the government to do more things, more better, more of the time, was really, really pervasive here in D.C. at least. And I think it's a lesson for us libertarians that saying, hey, look, the government is shut down, maybe you don't actually need bureaucrats to, chronicle every little bit of your life and tell you what to do is not a very effective libertarian talking point.
Nick, you were mentioned there. You have a 30-second chance to respond.
I was appalled by during the shutdown how the narrative was less about what the government workers were doing for us, and it was more about the pain and suffering of the government workers who were furloughed and whatnot. I think what this shutdown actually showed was how many things, and I guess this is what Catherine is getting to, is how many basic things that the government is doing that we should be outsourcing all of the time. First and foremost, air traffic control and airport security. There's just no reason that the state is the first line of employment in those things. They're not good at it. They don't do it. And then you subject it to, the whims of political idiots, which are now running, officially running every house of Congress and, the White House and probably the Supreme Court.
Suderman, what did you learn during the government shutdown?
Like Nick, I think, the first thing that we learned is that the TSA and the air traffic control should not be subjected to political uncertainty. They should be run privately, perhaps with some federal oversight, and that there is a huge cost in terms of convenience to air travelers. And potentially, they were warning that that there were potentially safety issues as a result of this, because we have made the TSA in particular and the air traffic control union, because we have made them government workers. then when our politics gets messed up, as it is very messed up in Washington right now, that has the potential to, again, to threaten the safety of air traffic, of people who are air travelers. And I think that's a real problem, and it is overlooked often in the debates about whether about how to organize and structure those things. But the other thing we learned is that not only were shutdowns, was this shutdown pointless? Shutdowns of the government are almost always pointless, and they don't get libertarians anything. You might like the idea that it's sort of a demonstration project, that the government is doing a little less, but it costs us more. It costs the economy. There is the CRFB, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, estimates that this cost about $26 billion, about the cost of a hurricane in terms of lost economic activity. It has slowed down consumer confidence because we are backpaying all of the workers and additionally paying interest on some of the contractors who we didn't pay during the shutdown. This is actually going to cost taxpayers more. Trump didn't get his wall, but might in the end end up declaring a state of the emergency. Not a great libertarian outcome there. And then finally, the biggest legislative outcome that is, I think, likely to come from this is that there is now a bipartisan consensus that federal workers should not be should be paid should something like this happen again, should there be a budget showdown. And so we are likely now to get legislation that ensures that federal workers get paid and that shutdowns like this can't happen again. So there was no limited government victory at all. If anything, it was a limited government own goal. I mean, this makes things worse, I think, in the long run. And again, I'm not against shutdowns per se if they are going to get us something. But this shutdown got us nothing. And I just don't see any sort of anything positive to come of this.
It also got me some sads about what people think libertarians believe. I mean, I had a lot of conversations that were like, you must be happy. The government shut down. And, you know, it's basically just the more genial domestic version of like, why don't you go move to Somalia? Like, it's, you know, it's such a misunderstanding.
Yeah, why don't you?
Yeah, good point. It's such a misunderstanding of, you know, what our goals are. And in particular, I think it's a misunderstanding in the direction of like, don't y'all just want to watch the world burn, which we talk about all the time on this podcast. You know, aren't you happy that things are in chaos? And it's like, I love order so much. I just want everyone to have good rules that they can follow voluntarily. Is that so much to ask?
I mean, I think the other thing that we learned here is that Donald Trump is not a good negotiator. Like, really, really
not a
good
negotiator.
He got completely
part of the deal
by Nancy Pelosi, who is awful in so many ways and so wildly wrong on so many policy issues, but is a really effective government operator and manager. And she played this perfectly. And Donald Trump are who ran on I make great deals, got nothing from this. Nothing at all.
You know, one of the things that's disturbing from a policy perspective for me is that the one thing that did change over time is that every Democrat, including Pelosi, including Schumer, including Julian Castro, every would-be presidential candidate from the Democrats started talking about how much they loved border security and they want border security. They just don't want a wall. And to me, that's a huge setback because they've got the Democrats to at least articulate that they want to maintain like the current immigration system with internal checkpoints, with E-Verify, with this and that, and with drones instead of walls. And it's a real shame because our immigration system is so completely broken because we insist on prohibiting, you know, the number of people who want to come here from working and living here legally. And I think this is where I agree with you, Peter, that Pelosi, you know, won this showdown, but it's not clear like what's going to happen down the road a little bit, because the fact of the matter is Trump almost single-handedly put immigration on the national agenda, and we're fucking talking about immigration at a point when, you know, there's less illegal immigrants in the country than there has been in a decade. They're coming in lower numbers. They're coming from different countries. They're overstaying their visas rather than bum rushing the border. And like we're having this incredibly stupid conversation about something that should not really be at the front and center of anybody's legislative of.
I mean, I think immigration was on the national agenda for a decade prior to Trump. I mean, there were, you know, the Gang of Eight bills, and there were.
But it kept getting pushed aside because it wasn't that important. And even like in the Nevada primary of Republicans, it was something like only 11% said that immigration was a major issue. The current Republican Party, it's now you have to be against immigration and you have to be against abortion. I mean, I think he put that at the center of a national agenda in a way, along with crime, too. I mean, like he's actually, this is where he might be a shitty negotiator in any given deal, but he is setting the table.
He certainly
pushed
the Republican party in a more anti-immigration direction, whereas it was split before, and has made the wall and his kind of supporting Trump in general political terms, even beyond any kind of particular policy, kind of the center of the Republican Party agenda, almost to the exclusion of all else. There's a great quote from Mark Meadows, the chair of the Freedom Caucus, Republican Freedom Caucus, who told Vox, "The communication strategy for our vision for America is still really yet to be determined." Yeah.
Catherine, one of the reasons why comprehensive immigration reform, and this is sort of to go to Nick's point here, failed in 2007 and again in 2013 was over the question of border security. A lot of it was, what do we do with the population of illegal immigrants as well? But kind of the political takeaway at the time, particularly from the immigration restrictionist or hawks, was like, hey, we got to do border security first. I recall Michael Chertoff coming by the LA Times editorial board when I worked there, and after that had fallen apart, saying, well, you know, we're going to really now enforce, we're going to go above and beyond in enforcing the border now, because we have to show people, you know, demonstrate that we can do border security first. Is it possible that that is an unfalsifiable goal or desire? Like, there's never going to be enough border security for people who say things, as Ben Carson and other people said during the 2016 campaign, we have to seal the border. Since you cannot seal the border, are we at a point where, like, if we keep saying do border security first, that just means we're going to keep doing border security and never actually going to do a goddamn other thing about the immigration system?
You are correct. No, I mean, it's like saying to a kid, like, you can have candy after you eat your broccoli, and then putting like four heads of broccoli on their plate and like two more in the steamer. Like, the border will never be secure enough that people will be like, okay, good, we took care of that. Excellent. Cool. Now let's let the immigrants in. Like, that will never happen. And anyway, even if for some miraculous reason we did build like a perfect, undig underable or climb overable or otherwise circumventable fence along the entire length of the border, then the argument would just shift to, okay, well, we have to do entitlement reform.
An invisible energy dome.
Invisible energy dome, like Wakanda or something. And then
we'd have to make one of those like science fiction kind of energy noise things when you get close to it.
Like that,
right?
Yeah. Oh, look at, we all made good science fiction noises. But even if we did that, the conversation would just shift to entitlement reform.
Hey!
Which I know sounds fun. I would love to talk about entitlements,
but not if it's
like we have to reform entitlements before we can let a single good gosh darn immigrant into our country.
On Friday, I wrote something and got pushback on Twitter from someone saying, you know, when do you reason open border types ever going to get tired of sounding like 1991 normie Cato on immigration, which we get every single time that we talk about it on some level, from people who self-identify as libertarians. They've been reason readers forever, and they just despise everything that we say about immigration because we're in the tank of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, I'm a paid representative of Duolingo, so that you know, every time somebody listens to a free Spanish lesson online, I get 25 pesos.
Yeah. What can we say? What can you say to address those people? Why should they care about our point of view on this when they feel like it's the elites who are conspiring against them to not defend America's national interest?
I don't know. And this is, I puzzle over this a lot. And I say this as somebody who spent a, you know, most like half of the past 20 years, basically in the in southwestern Ohio, a part of the country that does not have a lot of immigrants, either from outside the U.S. or from within the U.S. It's an out-migration zone. And it is weird because when you live in places where there are immigrants versus where there are not, you see the difference, and the difference is in the vibrancy of the local economy and the culture, you know, and whatnot. And I don't know. I mean, I think the one thing that we need to, you know, constantly be stressing is that all of the factual bases that anti-immigrant people tend to reach for, you know, increases in, you know, they're carrying drugs, they're committing crime, they're carrying disease. None of those things is true. And every time when you pin them down, they'll admit, yeah, okay, it's not true, but then there's this, or then the culture is falling apart. I mean, you saw over the weekend, there was a kind of hilarious on whatever it is, Meet the Press, Tom Brokaw, who is, you know, like in early, you know, senescence, he went on a thing about how, you know, it's really up to the Spanish, like Spanish speaking people, to learn the language and assimilate faster if they want more immigration. And it's like, there's everybody who studies it, you know, says that like when Spanish speaking immigrants get here from Mexico, especially, but other Latin American countries, they're learning English at the same rate that everybody always has, or a little bit quicker. By the third generation, nobody is in a Spanish dominant household. They're outmarrying from Hispanics or Latino groups. It's nuts. It's like a fundamentally, you know, it's a disconnect. And I don't know how you.
So you're saying, just hold on here, that contra the president of the United States, the cost of illegal immigration on Friday was not $603,331,392 dollars.
Well, first off, I think it should be in euros because I am a cosmopolitan and I denote everything in either in Bitcoin or euros, but.
Peter, before we leave the topic, so I was writing about this stuff on Friday, preparing a post, and this is before we knew exactly that the government shutdown was going to end and how and why, and I sketched out five possible scenarios of shutting it down and trying to work through my own brain, like what's the most likely, and I had an aha moment. I'm like, oh, I will rank these in my own head by the amount of responsibility it would require politicians to take. So the least amount of responsibility that it would require politicians to take as an end of the shutdown was, I concluded on Friday morning, that they just come up with a continuing resolution and kick the can down the road to some future thing. So the second least possible, you know, national emergency, it immediately gets tangled up in courts. And sort of blocked, at which point he says, I did what I could against the swamp. They do another CR for X number of weeks or months, probably till September. And then that's it. So that's what's going to happen, right?
I think that an emergency declaration is quite likely. I don't think I quite want to predict it. It's not nearly certain, but
why not? Why not? If you're right, you'll be visionary. And if you're wrong, nobody will hold you accountable.
Something else might happen. And I want to provide my best estimation of what is likely or not likely to our listeners.
You're an
idealist.
I just
like precision where I can have it.
An idealist.
So few places.
That's true. But in cocktails and perhaps in estimates of how likely the government shutdown is, I would say it's about like 60%. Not sorry, an executive.
Is there a role-playing game?
Emergency order. Yeah. It's about 60%. I think there's about a 60% chance. And look, the thing here is that Trump, the wall was never a meaningful policy goal for immigration restrictionists. You listen to folks like Mark Krikorian, and they will say, oh, sure, of course, I support a wall, and they do, but they will say it's a lower priority because, in fact, the wall is not really a great tool for restricting immigration, which they really would like to do. They would much prefer workplace-based tools like E-Verify, that sort of thing. And so the wall was a symbolic was basically a kind of symbolic policy. Trump only sort of understood that. But Trump likes building stuff and like symbolism. And so what Trump wanted from all of this, I think, was to be seen fighting for something, fighting for immigration restrictionism. And so if he declares that emergency and then gets tied up in court for the next couple of years, he can say on the campaign trail, which we are now obviously entering here, he can say for the next 2 years leading into the election, I am fighting for this. And the state, the deep state, sort of the beltway establishment, the swamp, they're fighting me. I'm doing what I can and trying to make this happen. And that's what I think Trump wants, is a symbolic policy that he can be seen fighting for. And the emergency declaration is probably the shortest route to that, which is why I think it's more likely than not.
Can I want to make a very imprecise but heartfelt a prediction, which is that Trump will declare a national emergency, and it won't really matter. Like, what that will show, just as the government shutdown didn't show that government is so vital that, you know, fuck, if we go 2 days without government, we're screwed. He's going to declare a national emergency on the border, and it will have virtually no effect on anything. And what will be revealed yet again is the disconnect between what people in power, whether they're populists or nationalists or establishments or beltway types, and what they can deliver is like miles and miles apart.
Weren't you the one who was worrying on this podcast 2 or 3 weeks ago that if Trump did that, that it would be a kind of an autocratic move that would prove some of his critics right?
Absolutely. It will. I mean, it is an autocratic move. It's nuts. You know, I mean, because it's been a long time since there's been like a serious national emergency declared on domestic, you know, property and stuff like that. But realistically, it'll be like it's going to be like the separating the families at the border and things like that. It will be, to the extent that it's actually done at all, it will be such a clusterfuck that he'll immediately walk away from it.
That's the Trump presidency, is it's both awful and completely ineffective.
Well, I think it also depends on, I mean, like, the, you know, when Trump was running for president, one thing that he said over and over was, unlike my opponents, I will not telegraph my next move. You got to surprise people. You got to hit them, you know. And so this was his justification, and is his justification, for not using conventional methods to vet policies and not doing the kind of, you know, run it through the deep state thing that previous presidents have done for both diplomacy and also domestic policy initiatives. But in this case, he's telegraphed the bejesus out of this maneuver. And I think, you know, one could argue one reason he's done that is because everyone understands the way that this goes down, as Matt was saying, ideally, is if he does do the declaration, like, all the paperwork is already done. Like, the court stay of whatever he does will happen instantaneously. There will be actually no moment of legal confusion about the status of the emergency, because all of the pieces have now been teed up to just put us back into a slightly different static equilibrium of fuckery.
And before we move on, let's just sort of reiterate, it's not an emergency. The emergency is that Donald Trump isn't getting the stupid symbolic thing he wants from Congress, which Congress has every political and legal procedural right not to give him.
Peter, they're duct taping ladies at the border or something.
That's right. They're duct taping them. That is, I just can't believe that
and
is part
drugs,
of our national
district. They're killing the Americans.
Do you think that duct tape is happy about that? Like, the duct tape manufacturers?
Hey, I mean,
like,
there's, you know, no problem too big for duct tape to fix, Nick. So,
yeah. The next thing he's going to be talking about, beer can chicken. That's my prediction.
Hey,
that'll
that
be
stuff
the next
is pretty
product
good.
Placement. Yeah.
I'm sometimes happy for my ignorance. Speaking of which, let's shift
Me
gears
too, Matt.
To
Me too.
Foreign policy and the turbulence down in Venezuela last week in a pretty dramatic and surprisingly kind of well-coordinated move, regardless of what you think of it. The United States led a global initiative to stop recognizing the awful president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, and start recognizing a self-proclaimed interim president. I think he's the head of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, as the country's interim leader. Many countries, including in Latin America, have followed suit. Canada, Israel, as well. I think the European Union, Brazil, you know, a well-run country like Brazil, Argentina, Peru, I think France, Britain, and Germany are now saying, you know, have a new election in 8 days, and or else we're going to do that too. Meanwhile, on the other side of the diplomatic divide, China and Russia and Cuba, who are the big three sponsors of socialist Venezuela, are digging in their heels. There's even talk that Russia is going to send some aircraft, and the U.S. is appointing Elliot Abrams. They got him out of the sarcophagus and wheeled him out to oversee this policy. Marco Rubio is on television every half a second saying, like, I can't tell you everything about what's going to happen. I could just say that it can get a lot more serious from here. And then he smiles. And
that is one of the worst impersonations.
It wasn't really one. It was sort of a Bat Welch doing Marco Rubio. But anyways, it leads to a lot of interesting and potentially scary questions. So let's go with Catherine first on this. Just about the politics of non-recognition. Are you comfortable with the U.S. Even on its own saying, you know what, President Jerkbag, I don't recognize you. I recognize the opposition leader, let alone organizing a global movement towards that.
Yeah, I mean, so I was trying to think about, okay, what if the positions here are reversed? Because we are notoriously bad as a nation at kind of having perspective of, like, you know, Russia's meddling in our elections. And then we're like, okay, no, but we literally are meddling in your elections. But, like, so this is basically, let's say that in 2020, the whole process of the election is just very, very messy. And there are reasons to believe that Trump manipulated the way that the election outcome came out, which, you know, I don't think is likely to happen, but is not a scenario that is uncontemplatable for many people in America right now. And say for whatever reason, Pence is out of commission or similarly implicated in the election shenanigans.
You mean by being Trump's vice president?
Trump's vice president, for instance. And then imagine that the House puts Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the speakership and then swears her into the presidency. Like, that's what just happened. That's literally what just happened. Like, it's exactly the same order of succession. Like, in fact, if the president and vice president are out of commission, it is the leadership of the House that takes over. And when you think about it that way, if you then imagine all of the world's vaguely socialist countries getting together and being like, that's my real president. Like, we would not be happy about that. And even if you really thought that the election was extremely corrupt and that Donald Trump was extremely bad, I would still not feel good about Russia, China, and Cuba being like, AOC is now America's president. Let's fight about it. So
there would be so many Facebook memes.
Oh my God, the memes.
I got to tell you right now, though,
but I mean, like,
we were
Russian
in America
Facebook
where
memes.
People had lost 25 pounds in the past year on average, I think, you know, we'd be okay with anything.
Right. So, I mean, obviously the situation in Venezuela is in no way comparable to the situation in the United States for lots of reasons. But, you know, I do think from the perspective of, yeah, like, of international, you know, diplomacy, about how we think about legitimacy, like, it is not so far off to make that parallel and imagine ourselves in that position. And I am sympathetic to people who are saying this is not the U.S.'s business.
This is the question of, like, where libertarians, this is, you know, because libertarians cannot ever, you know, be in a stable coalition with anybody for more than 5 minutes. This is one of the limits of that, where it's like,
which is a problem
Maduro
for an hour long podcast
Chavez
of libertarians.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is like, you know, it's like, no, you know what? We should not be about regime. We should not be fomenting regime change. And I think the things that we, you know, there are sanctions against certain Venezuelan high command people, which I'm not necessarily against, but if we have broad sanctions against Venezuela and we're not actually at war with them, that's fucked up. If we're fomenting regime change in countries, that's messed up. And the one thing that we know for sure under Trump, who is terrible on this, like, he's not going to do anything to help refugees from Venezuela. And that would be the one thing that I think a lot of people, including libertarians, could agree on.
So,
it's like, you know, let's bring in more people.
I don't actually know the answer to this because I am a boorish and parochial American, but we're not really fomenting, right? We're just endorsing as far as we know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess Brazil is more fomentish.
Brazil is a little fomentier, but, like,
we are talking about, you know, and yeah. I
mean,
heard
I think
people
there is
over
a
the
distinction,
weekend
I
talking
guess.
About, oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
there's a,
no,
there's
I agree.
A distinction,
I mean,
between kind of doing an old school, you know, send in the CIA to overturn the government.
Right.
Well, Donald Trump in 2017 explicitly said that Venezuela better watch its back or else we're going to take care of a problem in our own hemisphere. And it's been a consistent theme in his foreign policy approach and
as
speeches.
As it was with Obama and Bush. I mean,
it's been more directly kind of a threatening language towards Cuba and Venezuela and a stress of, we're not going to get in other people's hemispheres, but we're going to get in our own
Obama
hemispheres.
Obama did levy sanctions on Venezuela, on Venezuelan leaders and their bank accounts and things like that.
But he never.
Hillary Clinton did try to do her best to fuck up the election in Honduras during her time as Secretary of State. So I agree.
Correct.
I mean, if
you could put your whataboutism just on pause.
But I'm a tool of the Soviet Union, Matt. I'm waiting for that to come back.
Pertaining to Venezuela, I was talking to our friend Michael Moynihan about this last week, who pays a lot of attention to Venezuela and used to go there when they allowed him to. And he was saying that on their state TV, they play every half hour or so a clip of Donald Trump saying that maybe regime change in Venezuela wouldn't be a bad idea. And that all of the opposition people in Venezuela have been basically saying, Trump, shut up. This doesn't help. This is the eternal lesson that the Elliot Abramses and the Nicholas Negropontes, who I'm sure is next to be teed up in this charade, and certainly Marco Rubio's, never really learned, is that everyone wants to sit around and say, wouldn't it be great if we stood up for freedom so much that we inserted ourselves into this process? But when you do that, the people locally do not own their own revolutions. And the difference between revolutions of the last 60, 70 years, the ones that stick are the ones that are homegrown, and the ones that are fomented from abroad, whether by us or by other imperialist aggressors, don't last because they don't have a modern legitimacy. And I forgot what my question was.
So I just want to add in here, since we're talking about Trump and Venezuela, that there's a report on Axios last night in which the reporter Jonathan Swan had a conversation with Lindsey Graham, of all people, who recalled
who is really feeling himself.
Yeah,
these days.
He really is. And so are all of us, in metaphorically speaking. And Graham apparently, told Swan that Trump asked Lindsey Graham, what do you think about using military force in Venezuela? And Graham, of all people, super hawk Lindsey Graham responded, well, I think you need to go slow on that. That could be problematic. And Trump, like, actually in a kind of good question was like, well, I'm surprised. I thought you wanted to invade everybody. This is what Graham said. Huh? This is Graham's recollection of that conversation. So first of all, that's funny because Lindsey Graham. And second of all, it continues to be this sort of situation is where you worry that Donald Trump will decide that it's time to test out his new toy, the American military. And the the folks who have supported Trump because he is less hawkish and less interventionist, I think should be wary of this kind of situation, because this is the sort of place where Trump is going to be really tempted to intervene and to use American military force in a way that, as you've said, will be completely counterproductive if he does.
Let's talk about future commanders in chief here as we near the third quarter of this Super Bowl of a podcast. Two bits of news that jumped out at me was one, obviously the independent candidacy of Howard Schultz, former Starbucks CEO, I think.
Outgoing CEO.
Outgoing, okay. Last night on 60 Minutes. And also Elizabeth Warren made some news last week, as did Kamala Harris, but let's focus on Elizabeth Warren here, talking about a new tax scheme on the rich, which I think she's on Twitter said that I just want to tax the tippy top of the income earners. So the tippy top tax is going to come down on us on 2020. Let's start with that bit of it, since that seems to be very much in the Democratic air right now, Peter Suderman? I know you were looking at it. What are we learning about the tippy top tax and other ideas out there in the Democratic field, and what can we expect?
So Elizabeth Warren is out front with something like a substantive proposal here, unlike AOC's 70% marginal tax rate. That was basically just sort of an idea that she has talked about. She hasn't actually released any paper. Warren is following up with something that is a little more fleshed out. And it is a terrible, unworkable, and probably unconstitutional idea. It's basically
unconstitutional.
It is basically the idea is to levy a wealth tax on Americans who are worth more than $50 million. So who decides that and how? And so this is the unworkable part, is that you basically have to have the IRS go in and assess all of the assets for very rich people. But very rich people own a lot of unique assets that are difficult to assess. Maybe you've got an art fortune. Maybe you've got a lot of property or a business or intellectual property. If you, for example, owned, just imagine somebody who somehow or another had got the rights to Spider-Man and refused to develop them in any way. And so they were the sole owner of the rights to Spider-Man. How much is Spider-Man worth if Spider-Man isn't being developed? Now, in one sense, Spider-Man is potentially worth billions of dollars
a
year. But if you're not...
Him.
What is...
In any case, you can see here. Yes, you are. You can just imagine all of the things that rich people own that are weird, that are extremely unique and expensive. The IRS would basically have to go through and be like, every year, we're going to decide how much this is worth. And so you can imagine the IRS having to decide how much the unused rights to Spider-Man are worth and then levying a wealth tax on this or whatever.
So it's totally impractical.
And this is one of the reasons.
No, but wait. But rich people know how much they're worth.
There are estimates, but in fact, it's actually quite difficult in a lot of cases to figure out precisely. And because this is a tax on people who are worth over $50 million, I have a strong suspicion that you would end up with a lot of people who are surprisingly worth, you know, 46, 48, 49.5, not billion, million. Million. And like, you know, just sort of right on the line there. And again, this is a thing that you saw with Donald Trump and his father and their real estate business, is that there was a huge amount of kind of scammy valuation stuff going on with a bunch of their real estate back in the 70s and 80s. The New York Times did a big piece on this. And that's one of the ways that they managed to pay a lot less tax. Again, you can argue that there's a justification for this because people should pay as little tax as possible. But like there was some fraud involved in there, much more than just sort of legal arrangement. So anyway, it's impractical. Countries that have tried this have the trend has been towards stopping it, towards eliminating these taxes because they are so impractical, because they don't end up raising a lot of money, because rich people figure out ways to avoid these taxes. So it used to be that about a dozen countries, and I believe it's now just four in the OECD, have these. And finally, because this looks like a direct tax, which is unconstitutional, there is a strong argument. I wouldn't say an absolutely definitive argument, but a strong argument that it is totally unconstitutional, and that as soon as this policy got put in place, it would end up in court. I think we can be certain of that. And so I think the bigger picture here is not just that she's proposing an unworkable policy that other countries have gotten rid of that is probably unconstitutional, but that Elizabeth Warren is running on a symbolic policy that is just just class warfare. And that term gets rolled out kind of stupidly a lot of the time when talking about Democratic tax proposals. It's, oh, they want to raise the top marginal rate from 35% to 37%. Class warfare.
But
this is class warfare. This is real class warfare, and it's totally symbolic, and it's just awful, and a really sort of terrible sign of where our politics are and where they're headed. And
yeah, I agree.
Thank you
with
for allowing
that,
me
Peter.
That. Rant.
And
thank you for
and
coming
I,
to my TED Talk.
I mean, I think one of the things that I don't think that the progressive people in the Democratic Party who are putting all of this stuff out there, They don't understand how this is going to play out. And it's kind of a recognition that we cannot run a, you know, deficits forever, and that we need more revenue if we want to maintain the level of government that we have now or even come close to it in the future. And that what's going to happen, because these taxes don't work, I mean, you know, regardless of constitutionality, they're just not very pragmatic. You end up with VAT taxes and consumption-based taxes, which hit the poor as much as they hit the rich, or actually even more so. And that the secret that nobody in the kind of progressive movement wants to admit is that European social welfare states are paid for by poor people, like lower class, working class, and middle class people. They are not, you know, Veronique de Rougy did this for us a couple of years ago. The United States, according to the OECD, has one of the, if not the most progressive tax system in the country, where the richer you are, the more you pay. And in fact, in places like Europe, you get stuff back from the government. You might get more back, but you're also paying much more in at lower levels. And this, you know, this kind of cognitive dissonance has not yet breached the walls of progressives. But AOC and Elizabeth Warren and other people like that, they're actually going to usher in an age of high taxation on middle class and lower middle class people.
Catherine, is it moral to have $50 million when we haven't even eradicated ringworm from Alabama?
Yep. That's how I'm answering all your questions this podcast. So think about your next question to set me up. Yeah, I mean, in this case, somebody, maybe even someone on Reason staff, tweeted back at the "I am thinking about considering running for president" tweet from Howard Schultz and said, "Hey, here's a better idea. Why don't you just take whatever money you would have spent on this dumb vanity project and just match Bill Gates's spending on vaccines and actually make the world a better place?" And, you know, that's a sort of snappy comeback. But I think, you know, there's a little bit of irony is too strong a word, but there's a little bit of weirdness, tension in the fact that we are simultaneously saying, you know, one part of the Democratic Party is saying we need to make very, very, very rich people basically cease to exist. We need to take away so much of their wealth at the very top levels that category of tippy top mega rich people just cease to exist. At the same time, there's a very legitimate conversation happening in our politics right now about whether people like Michael Bloomberg and Howard Schultz are the safety valve in our messed up electoral politics, whether someone who is so rich that they can completely self-fund a presidential campaign outside of the party system might be a good way to fix this broken thing. That's the kind of benefits you get from really, really crazy rich people. You get rockets that are just because somebody wants to go to the moon.
So explain to me how we benefit from these rockets that like...
Because in a minute, we're going to get to go to the moon. Like, it's not here yet. Maybe it never will be.
Did you see that Tesla flying in the sky like the opening of the heavy metal movie?
The thing is that I know how much joy you derive, Catherine Mengele,
personally from rockets,
just from watching like the Blue Origin videos. Yep.
Catherine's rocket happiness is at least 0.01% of GDP.
Yes, that's correct.
I think it's
a reminder that the GDP doesn't measure everything.
Oh, true. Thanks for that happiness research.
It is worth confronting the naked class warfare that is going on and exposing it as fundamentally false, though, because it's like AOC is the one who said, you know, that like billionaires shouldn't exist. That's immoral. And it's like, you know what? That's absolutely not true. And she's fundamentally wrong on every possible level. And
I mean,
her solution to that, the idea of that, oh, well, you know what? It's like, you know, if we didn't have billionaires, we wouldn't have ringworm in Alabama. And it's like these two statements are, you know, mentally mind-boggling.
Well, and if anything, inversely correlated, right? Like it's actually like, if anything, like ringworm gets eliminated from places because we have mega bazillion billionaires. And I know that that feels a little counterintuitive and that that's not the only way that those things can happen. But I mean, the other piece of it to me is always like, okay, maybe there is a worldview where you say, you know, this much wealth concentrated in a single person or a single family is immoral. But it's also immoral. Like any configuration where you take that wealth away from them by force is also immoral. And I think that that's a piece of the equation that gets underserved, that people don't talk about enough. But like, I get it. I mean, on Twitter this weekend, I saw and wound up falling down a rabbit hole. There's apparently a running joke between Eddie Lampert, who's the CEO of Sears, and Mark Cuban about who owns a mega yacht called the Fountainhead.
This yacht is very big.
Yes.
It's the biggest yacht, I think, or one of the biggest
yachts. I don't think
yachts.
It's the very biggest, but it's it is very big.
Enormous.
It's bigger than
and
some
it's like they literally, it's two people who are rich beyond imagining who have a running gag about whose giant yacht this is.
Giant Ayn Rand-inspired yacht.
And like, but, I get it, that funny. Feels wrong. That feels
so,
bad.
So just, Lampert,
if I can just point out, like, Lampert is the last man standing in owning Sears and trying to keep Sears and Kmart in business against all wise advice. Like, you know, it's like, pull out. And it's weird because he's exactly the type of billionaire who will be demonized and vilified. And he's made it his life work over the past decade and probably the next 20 years or whatever he's got left to keep Sears and Kmart in business. So it's like he's hardly, a robber baron. I mean, he's not like tying, women to train tracks or something like that. And then, duct taping them to train tracks and then making them pay really high short haul rates in order to before they get killed or anything. It's very peculiar. And I think, what we're seeing in the United States, because this was also the weekend where Bono at Davos said that capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty than any other ism.
Correctly.
And he went on
said
to,
that correctly.
He went on to say, that he thinks capitalism is amoral, not immoral, which is kind of interesting. And we could talk about that. But it's in the United States, we're having this sense of diminishing expectations of a static or shrinking pie. And one of the first things that happens in that kind of scenario is a class warfare game where suddenly, if we can only expropriate the excess wealth of, stinking rich people, we won't have any problems at the lower end of the economic scale, as if that ever works that way. I mean, it's just, and we're managing, I mean, this is where I think America is in a decline relative to the rest of the world, not in any absolute terms, but we're not recognizing that. And so we end up having these weird anxieties that we're going to end up with a lot of stupid policies like Make America Great Again, or tax the rich, eat the rich. It's not going to change anybody's long-term trajectory other than to make our economy weaker and poorer over time and more expensive for especially poor people. It's very frustrating.
I would just add that at least as concerning to me as the whole idea that that very, very rich people are somehow a policy failure, that they should not, that no one should be allowed to have or accumulate a fortune the size of Bill Gates's, is the related idea that private charity is a problem and that the government really ought to be doing, that money ought to be spent by the government instead. And this is something that I think we will hear even more of heading into 2020 that is already going around in kind of progressive circles, is that actually it's a problem that we have to rely on billionaires to start vaccine programs. It's a problem that we have to rely on billionaires to bail out Sears for to keep it open perhaps, and to keep those jobs going. And that's what the government is for. And I think that this is just a very destructive idea that basically says that if you are a successful and productive person who has accumulated a lot of wealth, that it is actually bad for you to then spend it on projects that are designed to help your fellow man. And
or it's a problem that these billionaires are bailing out our publications. Right. This is what we saw this weekend. OK, so or this last week there's been 1,000 layoffs of journalists this last week or some such thing. And the call for, someone to sort of capital D, capital S, like do something. And the fact that there are already quite a lot of do somethings by various states out there. And indeed by other countries, in Canada, they subsidize trusted news sources. Like there's a giant pool of government
money. I think it's like $600 million.
Yeah. I can't think
that's
of a
gonna
worse.
That's going to go well when Congress decides which sources are news sources are trusted.
I can't think of a worse something to do. But that idea stems from the same place as the we can't just trust rich people to do good things. We need to take the money away from them and then have a different group of powerful randomly assorted humans.
That's their representatives of the people's will.
I should point out to listeners here, I'm going to peel back the curtain a little bit. So right before
peel
we hit record.
Peel back the curtain or pull back the curtain?
Whatever, Nick. You know, okay. I mean, I thought that's Catherine's job to get.
I don't mind. I don't mind sharing the work. It's a big job.
I want to. Yeah, I want to like have a border patrol clamp down on mixed metaphors.
Too late. It's Mestizo more like an overstatement.
Metaphors, Matt. Well,
they're trying to sneak across the border into our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of my metaphors, but
Matt's
before
a metaphor
each,
coyote.
go ahead, Matt.
Put some duct tape on.
Y'all are duct taped. Before we start, we always are, you know, we're working on levels and things like that. And invariably, there are two conversations. The one is the Washington conversation that's happening between Catherine and Peter. And the other one is the New York conversation between Nick and myself. And because of the vagaries of recording, usually only one can be heard at any given time, or like you know, people are inflicting on the other. So that means either Catherine and Suderman I have to hear me and Nick laughing about like Dick Butkus and Pete LeCocq on one end. Or
you don't even need to know who those guys are to laugh about
them. Or my God, we're subjected
so
to whatever
juvenile. They're
garbage talk you guys were engaging in today about books, about expanded universes and Lord knows what. So that's a way to
it's true, Catherine and I were talking about the expanse.
Introduce the end of show. What are you consuming? And I hope that we all play to stereotype here. Suderman, you go
in
first.
In fact, I have been reading the fourth book in the Expanse series. it's pretty good. You know, it's, I mean, the author, James S.A. Corey, is actually the pseudonym for two separate guys who have co-written this massive space kind of... it's a space opera, but that veers into the sort of on the hard sci-fi territory. The kind of the theory behind this series is really interesting. It's well, you know, on the one hand, we have a lot of science fiction novels that have been written about humanity after we can explore the whole galaxy, the whole universe. And there are a lot of science fiction novels written about humanity only exploring the solar system, but there are very few about how we get from the solar system to the rest of the galaxy. And so this series, which is, I believe, planned to be 9 books, I don't think we're all the way there yet, this series is about the transition point and how that comes about. And it deals with kind of a number of factions human factions sort of within the solar system who are sometimes allied with each other and sometimes arrayed against each other. There's Mars, there's the Belters, the people who kind of live in the outer planets, and there's Earth, and there's a lot of resentments. There's sort of a political angle to all of this, which is that the UN is often trying to exert control, but then there are these private companies that sort of the UN has to negotiate with and are sometimes more friendly to the Belters or to Mars. And there's like back on Earth, one of the reasons that everybody out in the Belt planets resents Earth is because everybody on Earth has the option to go on BASIC, which is pretty much just a UBI. This series started as a role-playing game that these guys had invented and then spun off into a series of novels. It's really, it's been, you know, adapted into a series by the Sci-Fi Channel that has now been picked up by Amazon.
Which is my recommendation for this
And which
week.
Is Catherine's recommendation. So she can pick up and talk about the TV series, which I have watched
seriously,
a lot of.
This was honestly not coordinated at all. And absolutely my recommendation for this week is The Expanse, the TV series, which I will sell at somewhat shorter length since Peter has covered a lot of the good stuff already. The thing that's cool about the series is that it does quite a good job of balancing the, oh my God, we're all going to die if we don't unplug all the batteries from the thing and plug them into another battery. You know, we need to science the shit out of this kind of sci-fi thing. And also a very kind of stylish, noirish, you know, lots of broken people with messy relationships interacting on various places in the solar system.
And to tie it back to what we've been talking about, what are rich people good for? and rich corporations.
For this bananas.
Right. So
thing.
Sci-Fi canceled this show, even though it had been relatively well.
So much more money than
not
it knows
Netflix.
Sorry.
Jeff Bezos, who has been looking for a signature yes. science fiction show, because Jeff Bezos is such a sci-fi geek that the first time they showed him The Echo and said, you can play music on it, what he asked it to play, reportedly, was the Battlestar Galactica theme song.
Yeah.
And so
he did.
Jeff Bezos was like, oh, you're canceling The Expanse? I'm uncanceling it.
Yes. And so Amazon Studios makes it into a thing. The other piece of it, of course, that's interesting is, you know, you could easily, without working too hard about it at all, read it as a metaphor for our immigration troubles and the sort of the sense of who is other and who is outsider and who gets what resources and where the moral imperatives are there.
Nick, besides experiencing your own death a half a dozen times in the previous 3 to 4 minutes,
I'm trying to cause my own
can
death.
We when we tweet this podcast, I want to put a poll up about whether people like our stuff or your dumb stuff.
Oh,
that's not a
go ahead.
Bring it on.
Recommend something.
On,
recommend something by someone who should be dead already. Go ahead.
Or
okay.
Is
now? So I was reading this morning over the weekend. Walter Jones, the congressman, conservative congressman from North Carolina, who's in hospice care, he's about to die, 75 years old.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Who was the guy who started the? He was one of the two congressmen who started calling French fries "freedom fries" after France refused to go along with the invasion of Iraq in 2003. He changed his tune after he realized that we, you know, the weapons of mass destruction and all of the arguments that got us into Iraq were phony. And he has now become this incredible figure who, since then, writes letters to every American serviceman who's or woman who's killed in action. And he has pictures of dead soldiers outside of his congressional office, et cetera. What I'm getting to is what I read, which is a fantastic book from 2007, which is called Salem Witch Judge. And it's a biography of Samuel Sewall written by Eve LaPlante. It was originally published in 2007. And Samuel Sewall was one of the judges at the Salem witch trials. And then he realized very quickly that he had sentenced 20 people to death out of hysteria and just he was wrong. And he literally wore sackcloth for the rest of his life, made a point of doing penance for having usurped or used his authority poorly. And it's a fantastic book, Eve LaPlante's Salem Witch Judge from 2007. She also wrote a great biography of Anne Hutchinson called American Jezebel, which is also set in and around the Massachusetts Bay Colony around the same period. These are alternative, counterfactual histories, really, of where the U.S. what the U.S. could have become, along with books like Roger Williams and The Invention of the American Soul. It's fascinating to go back in history and look at people who had a radically different relationship towards power and authority and self-determination, and they just basically it didn't make it out of the colonies, and that's too bad. And I think Walter Jones is a modern day Samuel Sewall. And his principled switch and his public penitence for what he thinks he did wrong is really fantastic.
I like that. As soon as Catherine made this a competition, Nick is like, "I'm going to win this. I'm going to swat this out of the park."
I know what I'm about.
I will lowbrow this, unsurprisingly, but also in preparation of next Sunday's Super Bowl like 53 or 4 between the boring Darth Vader-like New England Patriots and the Los Angeles Rams. Sorry, I've followed professional football since forever. And so I binge-watched parts of the NFL Network's old archive of those great NFL film.
John Fushima? Fusenda. I'm sorry.
Just
Fusenda,
wonderful, wonderful voice.
It was third and long, and the gloom was gathering in the Green Bay Packers end zone type of stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, it was interesting to watch a bunch of them in the row. Obviously, the ones that I looked at were from the 1970s.
Peter and Catherine now are like putting needles at each other's eyes.
No, they're sorry. They're
this
is
like you guys feel just like took my earbuds out.
You
like
feel
I
like
can't.
The people at the end of Titanic, like dying in the frozen water.
I can't even.
But when you watch a bunch of them in a row, it's an interesting, you start looking at meta art of it. It reminds me very much of the kind of modern day reality show, game shows, cooking shows that are so incredibly like formalized. Like each one does this 5 minutes here. You do the Herb All Alpert right. music here, the up-tempo.
You
goes
have
in
the
this moment
guy
here,
landing in the jetpack sort of... at Super Bowl I during the halftime show or something.
Yeah, it's and this guy's voice, and also the writing is incredibly florid. It's like when the hunters would fake write sports writing leads. It's like that, and it's a kind of a terrific precursor. And you realize this was definitely part of the myth making machine that turned the NFL from what at the beginning was not kind of a big deal. I think the first couple of Super Bowls weren't even televised or not live, into this single massive cultural moment that we have on television every year, by far. Totally great. And I didn't subject myself to watching the Rams lose in Super Bowl 14 because it's too soon. And that's all the too soon that we have time for here.
By the way, Matt, there's a great new biography of Babe Ruth out.
Oh, yeah?
That I saw an hour-long interview
Peter, should we just go?
The author by Brian Lamb, and it looks fantastic.
That's terrific. Thank you all for listening to the Editor's Roundtable edition of the Reason Podcast. You know where to find this: Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Play, whatever the hell. Please rate and review us when you get there. And stay tuned for more great stuff throughout the week from the Reason Podcast. Goodbye.
I left a long time ago.